This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The bond notes they're issuing will not be useful for paying for imported goods. We really have to pay for those with US dollars all around or foreign currency. I think it is going to lead to scarcities.
That's economist John Robertson talking about the planned introduction of bond notes as a currency in Zimbabwe. Details coming up.
Also, according to Human Rights Watch, Kenya's efforts to repatriate 260,000 Somali refugees does not meet international standards. And the worldwide refugee crisis will be getting a major focus at the UN General Assembly in New York next week.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Kenya's efforts to repatriate 260,000 Somali refugees are coming under fire today. The group, Human Rights Watch, says the program is fueled by fear and intimidation and does not meet international standards for voluntary refugee return. The Kenyan government announced in May that it was speeding up the process to close the large Dadaab camp complex by the end of this year. Many have lived in the camp for more than 20 years, and some were born in Dadaab and have never been to Somalia. Kenyan officials claim the camp could be used by Somali al-Shabaab militants to launch attacks. Human Rights Watch says since the start of the repatriation process in December 2014, about 24,000 refugees had returned to Somalia. But the group says most have since returned to Dadaab. The rights group says repatriation was suspended late last month when Jubaland officials said they were not able to help returning refugees. No word on when the repatriation process will resume.
According to the UN Refugee Agency, there are about 60 million refugees worldwide. The crisis is so severe that both U.S. President Barack Obama and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon are hosting summits next week in connection with the opening of the UN General Assembly in New York. To better understand the refugee crisis in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Mark Hetfield, president and CEO of HIAS, the world's oldest refugee protection and resettlement organization.
Refugees continue to be a huge concern in Africa, particularly in Kenya, because like here, Kenya has some serious security concerns. In fact, terrorism has been exported from Somalia to Kenya, and refugees are often perceived or misperceived as being part of the problem. And so there have been significant crackdowns against Somalis, which include Somali refugees who fled for their lives. So our roles become very, very significant there. And also, Kenya has a policy of keeping most refugees in camps, and they are one of the biggest host countries and have long been one of the biggest host countries of refugees in the world, but they do not have a policy of integrating the refugees who flee there.
Tell us why that's a problem.
The problem is many refugees have now been there for one, two, three generations, and keeping them in camps is not sustainable. So other solutions have to be found, whether that's resettlement to third countries or integration or getting them ready for voluntary return. But these are all things that Kenya is constantly talking about and looking at.
And of course, Kenya's challenges with the refugees is not unrelated to the global situation, quite beyond African borders, correct?
Right. With so much attention being focused on the Middle East and Syria, I think Africa and Kenya in particular are feeling a little bit neglected by the rest of the world. They still have a huge refugee situation on their hands, but they're not getting much attention or much assistance. That's leading to actions such as the shutdown of the Dadaab refugee camp, which is one of the biggest refugee camps in the world.
And tell me, what is HIAS doing in other parts of Africa where the refugee crisis is especially urgent?
Kenya, as I said, was our first operation in Africa in 2002. But we quickly struck up relationships in Uganda as well to protect urban refugees, much like the refugees that we protect in Nairobi. And in Uganda, the population is different. It's largely refugees from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That's the largest number of our clients are people who fled the violence there, who have been themselves victimized by sexual or gender-based violence. And then we are also in Chad. We've been in Chad for about 11, 12 years now, assisting refugees who fled the genocide in Darfur. So we're in about a dozen refugee camps throughout the eastern part of Chad.
That's the situation in Chad. What about these other places? Are you trying to get them to these new places where they're not in refugee camps particularly, or you sort of just deal with what's needed at that moment?
HIAS has not been focused on being an emergency response agency. We are focused more on long-term solutions and integration. But when we opened in Africa, we realized that most refugees don't actually have access to resettlement. Very few do, as a matter of fact. Only 1% of refugees in the world are resettled. So the priority has to be to make them safe where they are, to either help them establish communities where they are or to help them prepare to go to return home when it's safe to do so. For example, the refugees that we assist from Darfur, they've been living in refugee camps in Chad for 10, 11 years now. So what we do is community services. We help refugees establish community structures, address community concerns. That's our focus, is making them not just feel like they have a community, but actually establish a community in their country of first asylum. But the goal for refugees is that they get to the point where they're no longer refugees. And the way to do that is through work, is through giving them access to work, is by giving their kids access to education so they can better themselves in their new society. And of course, resettlement is also a critical way, so they can actually get to a place where they can be safe, where a place that they can call home.
That was Mark Hetfield, President and CEO of HIAS International NGO, dedicated to the protection and resettlement of refugees. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Tomorrow night, in the second part of our two-part series on African refugees, we'll look at resettling African refugees in the United States.
In the latest news on migrants and refugees, media reports say local inhabitants of the Greek island of Chios scuffled with police last night. It happened as police blocked about 800 people from entering two migrant camps on the island. The protesters had demanded that 3,500 migrants and refugees on the island be removed. Police used tear gas to break up the protest. Greek media reports say some protesters allegedly were linked to a neo-Nazi party. Meanwhile, in Germany, police had to stop a fight between far-right group members and asylum seekers in the eastern town of Bautzen. Police say about 80 Germans fought with 20 migrants in the market square.
In Zimbabwe, the central bank says by the end of October, the country will introduce bond notes to the mix of currencies used by consumers. 6 years ago, Zimbabwe had an inflation rate of over 200 million%. Since then, it has relied on the U.S. dollar and the South African rand as local currencies. But dollars are in short supply, and President Robert Mugabe says the new notes will help prevent foreigners from taking U.S. dollars out of the country. John Robertson is an economist and consultant in Harare. Reporter William Eagle asked him why the bonds are being introduced now.
That's a difficult question, because it's really just to treat the symptoms of the problem, and the symptoms are that we lack the cash. As a developing country, we are a bit of an exception in the world, because countries that want to earn hard currency would normally have to deal with strong economies. But here in Zimbabwe, you can earn US dollars by having something to sell to the Zimbabwean population. And the US dollars are very popular in China and India and other countries. And so the shipment of US dollars out of the country in physical notes has caused a massive cash scarcity. But that's been worsened by the fact that we have a huge trade deficit. And that's because we've closed down most of our productive sectors. Manufacturing and agriculture are nearly dead. The mining sector is sort of functioning, but not very well. But the main thing is that we used to produce most of the consumer goods we required, and today we're importing them. So we're sending money out of the country to pay for them, and obviously over a period this has drained the resources we've had, it's drained the money we've earned from exports, it's drained our savings, and now we've got very little left. So the US dollars we can collect from a bank every day are rationed, and that scarcity is something they're trying to overcome with the bond notes, because they are right in thinking that nobody outside the country is going to want to take bond notes out of Zimbabwe, so these will remain here.
In fact, the government once before had used bond notes, did it not, in 2009, when you had, I believe, over 200% inflation. Could that possibly happen again with these new notes?
Well, it could be. In those days, of course, it was the Zimbabwe dollar we had. We ruined the Zimbabwe dollar by printing many hundreds of trillions of them. And, of course, we destroyed the value. That is because government couldn't raise the money it needed to meet its tax obligations and its expenditures. So they just simply decided to print more. And that's always been the case in history. If you print more money than your money supply can actually handle, the value will go down. And we came close to breaking the world record for inflation. Now, it could happen with these if they were to print a very large quantity of them. The government is claiming at the moment that they will not increase the print order above $200 million worth of bond notes. At that rate, it's not a big sum of money in, you know, spread amongst the population of 14 million Zimbabweans. Now, it'll be less than a dollar per person per month. But if they hold the print order to only $200 million, and it takes another year to get into circulation, I think that's not going to place an enormous risk of a value collapse. But whether we can trust the government to restrain themselves and not print any more of these notes, that is the real question.
If the bond notes are indeed released at the end of October, what effect would it have on ordinary Zimbabweans, that is, consumers?
The bond notes that they're issuing will not be useful for paying for imported goods. We really have to pay for those with US dollars or rand or foreign currency. And so nobody will be able to replace the stock they're selling if they are paid bond notes. And that would apply to the fuel as well. So people buying gasoline will not be able to do so if they're offering bond notes and the service stations are unable to use those notes to replace the stock. I think it is going to lead to scarcities. Food items make up more than 30% of normal spending. So whether you're talking about the industry or the milling industry or the people doing canned goods or bottles of tomato ketchup or soft drinks, the quantities that are available today from what's left of the farming sector is just not enough.
From Zimbabwe, that was economist John Robertson. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle.
The overuse of antimicrobials, drugs used against bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites, is causing major health concerns. More so-called superbugs are emerging that are resistant to them. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says it's a threat to humans and animals alike. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The FAO says there's been an increased use and abuse of antimicrobial medicines in both human and animal health care. It says that's contributed to an increase in the number of disease-causing microbes that are resistant to medicines traditionally used to treat them. This can be seen, for example, in multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. Antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, will be discussed at a high-level UN meeting on September 21st. But just how widespread is antimicrobial use?
We don't really know how much of the antimicrobials, including antibiotics, are being used in food and agriculture.
That's Dr. Juan Lubroth, Chief Veterinary Officer for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization.
In fact, we don't really know how much is being made who is buying, who is selling, how much is the international traffic, either as drugs ready to be used or the active ingredient inside a drug that is then formulated someplace else.
Lubroff says humans and animals are caught in a cycle of disease transmission.
We can get sick, they can get sick, they can die. They need the antibiotics to be given in the proper way so they can recover. So it's not only about food and agriculture, it's also about our dogs and cats, our mascots.
Misuse of antimicrobials includes failing to follow directions.
Even I'm guilty. My physician may have given me antibiotics to take for the course of a week, 7 days, and I stopped at day 6. Well, that's bad. That's not good. That's a misuse of the antibiotics.
That's a common way germs can develop a resistance to a drug. The FAO says that antimicrobial medicines play a critical role in the treatment of farm animals and plants. Their use, it says, is essential to food security, human well-being, and animal welfare. Lubroff says the Food and Agriculture Organization has developed a 4-part action plan for AMR.
One is to create the awareness among the general public of the issue. 2 would be to have the evidence, have the surveillance in place that I can monitor when the antimicrobial resistance appears, and I report it in a timely fashion.
The action plan also calls for strengthening governmental agencies dealing with public health, food and agriculture, and ensuring they share information with each other and medical professionals. The final recommendation is to promote good practices in food and agricultural systems and the prudent use of antimicrobials. They are often used in small amounts in animal feed to stimulate growth, despite growing calls to end the practice. Once in the livestock, they become part of the food chain.
I think that the consumers should be empowered to really push their governments or their food providers that they want safe food, wholesome food. I think we can all agree on that. We may disagree on some of the specifics of how to get there, but I think that the consumer and the voice of the consumer has to be heard.
Lubroff says the long-term consequences of not being able to use antimicrobials because of resistance would be great. He says the medicines bring a global public good to the planet. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 22 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. According to Human Rights Watch, Kenya's efforts to repatriate 260,000 Somali refugees does not meet international standards. And the worldwide refugee crisis will be getting a major focus at the UN General Assembly in New York next week. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Extremist groups are increasingly operating in the fragile states of North Africa and the Sahel. Experts say groups like Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and Elmer Abatoun in Mali are exploiting weak governments, crushing poverty and ethnic and social tensions. Anwar Bukars is a scholar at the Carnegie Middle East Program. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi asked him about the drivers of violent extremism in Africa.
I think experience suggests is that the drivers of violent extremism are multi-layered, and they have many overlapping causes, so cases differ. But I think we can agree that bad governance, government repression, political economic marginalization, especially of peripheral areas, play an important role. So relative deprivation, endemic corruption, like again the case of Tunisia, shows us, influence trajectories to violent extremism.
But how do terrorism, drug, and human trafficking contribute to the insecurity of North Africa?
The nature and difficulty of countering violent extremism or terrorism is compounded by what you just said, the menace of organized crime. Again, the problem happens in those neglected peripheral areas. What we see in Tunisia, in Algeria, and elsewhere, Mali definitely, the Sahel, drug trafficking, small arms, and violent extremism, they intermingle. So these armed violent extremists, they don't control the criminal economy or drugs, but they exert influence over it with the protection and the permission they are able to grant smugglers that are bringing, you know, loads of drugs or hashish or contraband. And the partnership is very worrying. Again, the partnership, especially in border regions, as we see in Tunisia, as we see in northern Mali, as we see in southern Algeria and other areas. So in any region where you have drugs and violent extremism, our companions, militant and traffickers, usually hail from the same tribal clan. We have seen it in Mali. We have seen it in Tunisia. And those alliances between organized crime and violent extremism, they risk becoming professionalized and more enduring. The drug trade offers the lure of easy money, as you know, to low-paid security officials, and also to the legions of unemployed and frustrated youth, again, in border regions and in the impoverished urban areas.
So what can Western powers do to improve the security situation in the North Africa and the Sahel?
They have to significantly increase their economic aid and mobilize international support to ease that social situation. There are specific remedies that governments and the international community can undertake to alleviate those factors that drive radicalization. Some are naturally developmental in nature, and they require a governance-oriented response. Reduce corruption, along with a determined effort to invest in those neglected geographic areas and ensure equal access to economic opportunity of aggrieved subpopulations. Again, this is exactly what's happening in Tunisia and in Mali and elsewhere. Wherever the international community has leverage, it must press local governments to reduce endemic corruption, to improve poor governance, and to engage credible civil society actors and also religious leaders. Support for local media outlets that emphasize an effective counter-narrative against violent extremism. My concern is that the focus in Tunisia and elsewhere is too much on security. So that's important, but without focusing on improving governance, security sector reform, rehabilitation programs for former fighters, I think we would not be able to counter, you know, the rise of violent extremism.
That's Anwar Boukhars, a scholar at the Carnegie Middle East Program. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
The political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.